Public company auditing, especially in the large firm context, is heavily dependent on proper supervision. Engagement teams are not sent out on their own to conduct audits as they see fit. On the contrary, firms have detailed audit manuals and elaborate systems of quality control designed to ensure that engagements are conducted in accordance with firm practice and with the applicable auditing standards. The effectiveness of these tools is, in turn, largely a function of the skill and diligence of the supervisory personnel throughout the firm's hierarchy who are charged with implementing them. Firms obviously cannot act or fail to act independent of their personnel. The actions of the firm are those of its partners and staff. When something goes wrong in an audit, the problem can frequently be traced to some type of supervisory breakdown. The Sarbanes-Oxley Act recognized the key role that proper supervision plays in auditing and the key role that supervisory failure often plays in audit failure. Section 105 of the Act authorizes the board to impose sanctions for failure to reasonably supervise an associated person who has violated the board's standards or the law. The Act also creates a defense that supervisors may invoke when they're charged with failure to supervise. That defense depends on the firm having established reasonable supervisory procedures, the individual having discharged his or her responsibilities under those procedures, and the absence of any reasonable cause to believe that the procedures were not being followed. The structure of sanctions for failure to supervise, coupled with an affirmative defense based on adequate procedures and good faith compliance, has been a familiar feature of the securities broker-dealer landscape for many years. Sarbanes-Oxley borrowed those concepts and directed the board to apply them to auditors. So far, however, the board has never brought a failure to supervise case. Since sanctions for failure to supervise are new to the world of auditing, may therefore not be entirely clear how and when the board intends to exercise this authority. The release the board is issuing today seeks to address those questions. The release outlines the basics of the statutory failure to supervise provision and explains how the board interprets them. The discussion is necessarily somewhat abstract. Although the release lays out the general parameters of supervisory failure, not every possible application can be spelled out in detail in advance. It's important to stress that this release is not intended to inaugurate a new framework for auditor supervision or to usher in a new era in which members of firm management can be charged whenever something goes wrong in an audit. The audit and quality control standards that the board inherited from the profession contain supervisory and quality control requirements. Those have always been enforceable and remain the principal source of supervisory responsibilities. Neither Section 105 nor the release impose new supervisory requirements. For that reason, engagement partners, individuals in charge of firm quality controls, and managing partners and practice heads who should not interpret the board's action today is opening the door to liability for failing to meet any new or different standards of conduct than those that they should have been meeting all along. They should, however, recognize that the release does mean that the board is prepared to address supervisory failures when they occur on a case-by-case basis through its enforcement program. As with the prior item, many individuals worked on the release, and I'd like to thank all of them for their efforts. They include Michael Stevenson, who headed the project, and Carrie Onofsky, both of whom are in the Office of the General Counsel. Ella Rivshin and Chris David in the Office of the Chief Auditor, and Claudius Modesti and Mark Caprellian in the Division of Enforcement and Investigations also played important roles. Our colleagues at the SEC have also devoted much time and attention to the release, and I appreciate their helpful and supportive input. Let me ask then if other board members have comments about this release. And again, I'll start with the move-ant, Mr. Niemeyer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gelder. I also want to thank the staff for developing this release to explain the provisions of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act that relate to supervision of the firm's audit practices. These provisions are a fundamental part of the Sarbanes-Oxley reforms to reinforce investor protection as the core of the culture of the accounting profession. The supervision provisions of the Act appropriately recognize that audits involve numerous individuals in an audit firm, not just people who serve on the engagement team. Indeed, senior firm management can have tremendous influence over audit quality, good or bad. They also typically are faced with competing incentives, including business and client pressures. The supervision provisions of the Act are an important counterweight against the kind of pressures that reduce audit quality and can lead to audit failures. The release does an excellent job of explaining to auditors how those provisions work. I'm also hopeful that with this reminder, firms will take a deep look at their supervisory structures and eliminate any impediments to audit quality. We do this on a case-by-case basis in inspections, but I see value in raising awareness in a broader way as well. I also look forward to public comment on our questions about whether additional rules on documenting supervisory responsibilities would be constructive. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Niemeyer. The motion was seconded by Mr. Harris, so let me ask you, Steve, if you have any comments you'd like to make.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As others have explained, the release the board is issuing today addresses two critically important objectives. The first is to remind auditors that the board has the authority and will use it to take disciplinary action against a registered public accounting firm or its supervisory personnel under the circumstances described in the release for a failure to supervise. The second objective addressed in the board's release is to solicit comment on specific comments for developing a rulemaking proposal that could lead to firms documenting the supervision responsibilities related to each audit, from the first line supervisor for each part of an audit all the way up to the responsibilities of the managing partner of the firm. There are, unfortunately, plenty of reasons to believe auditors may need a reminder of the board's disciplinary authority in this area. For the protection of investors, firms and their associated persons need to be vigilant about meeting their supervision responsibilities. Particularly in the current environment where auditors on a daily basis seek to identify and address the risks of misstatements in financial statements, enhanced and more attentive supervision should result in improved audits and fewer audit failures. Appropriate supervision of firm personnel is one of the essential ingredients for an audit practice to perform engagements in accordance with PCAOB standards and rules and other applicable law. Since coming to the board, I am struck by the volume of supervisory concerns brought to our attention by our inspections division. For example, in the board's December 2008 report on large firm inspections, the board identified inadequate supervision and review as an important factor that allowed audit deficiencies to occur. In addition to questions about the supervision and review activities of engagement managers and partners, the board identified supervision accountability-related concerns in several other areas, including partner evaluation and compensation processes, concurring review policies and procedures, internal inspection programs, and the evaluation, supervision, and control of work performed by foreign affiliates. Specifically, the board's large inspection report noted in various findings, that I quote from the report, certain deficiencies raise questions about the sufficiency, rigor, and effectiveness of the supervision and review activities of engagement managers and partners, including the thoroughness with which they reviewed audit documentation. In some cases, it appeared that the engagement partners had not devoted sufficient attention to their responsibilities, or their commitment to engagement did not appear to correlate with the risk the engagement presented. Certain of the deficiencies described above were in areas that required management's most difficult or complex judgments, and thus were in areas where the partners and managers should be devoting significant attention. The report goes on. Inspection teams identified instances where firms failed to appropriately evaluate, supervise, and control the work performed by their foreign affiliates on the foreign operations of U.S. issuers. The deficiencies included failing to A, resolve findings or matters identified by the foreign affiliates, and B, obtain the required information from one or more foreign affiliates. More recently, our staff issued a practice alert that, among other things, noted situations in which it appeared that registered public accounting firms used the work of assistants engaged from outside the firm, including assistants located in another country, without complying with the PCOB standards applicable to supervising those assistants. The amendments we are adopting today to the standards governing auditor assessment and response to risk reflect some of these same concerns. Because of our findings and concerns related to inadequate supervision of audit engagements, the board is considering whether to propose rules that would complement our disciplinary authority by requiring firms to document their assignment of supervisory responsibility to all levels of the firm related to audits. In developing such a rulemaking proposal, we should keep in mind what the provisions in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act concerning supervision were designed to achieve. At the very first hearing before the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee on February 12, 2002, on what later became known as the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, former SEC Chairman Richard Breeden suggested that regulators, quote, adopt duties for accounting firms to supervise the conduct of their audit professionals in a manner parallel to the express duty to supervise that broker-dealers have for their personnel. This duty to supervise is a very effective tool in overseeing brokerage firms and creates accountability for providing oversight that works, close quote. Other witnesses gave similar testimony about the importance of supervision standards. The drafters of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act accepted these suggestions and borrowed extensively from the provisions governing broker-dealer supervision of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. A key feature of the broker-dealer model of supervision is that accountability for supervision extends all the way to the top of the firm. As Professor John Coffey explained at a meeting of the Board Standing Advisory Group on February 27, 2008, financial responsibility for proper supervision rests with the firm's president or chief executive, which creates incentives for senior executives to minimize their own liability by making sure they have qualified compliance and supervisory personnel in place and by responding appropriately to red flags that suggest misconduct may be occurring. At the same Standard Advisory Group meeting, Barbara Roper, Director of Investor Protection for the Consumer Federation of America, noted, I think it is absolutely clear from the context in which this came up in the Sarbanes-Oxley discussion that it was the intention to create a more robust system than existed at the time, and that that system was intended to include accountability all the way up to the top of the firm. One of the frustrations at the time was the inability to hold people at the top of the chain accountable for problems that occurred on their watch. As these congressional witnesses and SAG discussions suggested, the drafters of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act looked to the broker-dealer model of supervision. The drafters understood how effective this kind of accountability could be in keeping all levels of management personnel of registered public accounting firms consistently focused on their responsibilities to protect investors and to serve the public interest through the performance of high-quality audits. The drafters therefore stated clearly in the law that supervisory personnel are accountable for failing reasonably to supervise the firm's associated persons as required by the board's rules relating to auditing or quality control standards or otherwise. The text and legislative history of the Act, comments made at the board's February 2008 Standing Advisory Group discussion together with the board's numerous inspection findings and other experiences to date, as noted, for example, in the large firm inspection report, confirmed that there are good reasons for the board to explain and use its disciplinary authority and to promulgate supervision rules that would reinforce accountability at all management levels of registered public accounting firms. No question in my mind that the drafters of Section 105(c)(6) of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002 contemplated rulemaking in this area, and I hope that the board acts to clarify who within a firm is accountable for various supervisory responsibilities that bear on the quality of the firm's audits. I am pleased to vote in favor of this release. View it as a much needed. Welcome first step and look forward to considering the comments. I know that a number of offices were involved in working on this release, but Mr. Chairman, I follow you in commending the excellent work of Michael Stevenson, Carol Yanovsky, Bella Rivshin, Chris Dodd, and also in the enforcement area, Mark Aprilian and Claudius Modesti. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gradison?
I have nothing really to add, Mr. Chairman. I support this and look forward to the benefit of the public comments.
Okay. Thank you. Let me ask about a couple of points in the release. And first, maybe I'll ask a variation of the question that I asked during the earlier discussion. Now, we've just adopted auditing standard number 10, which largely deals with the responsibilities of the engagement partner to supervise the engagement, the engagement team and other aspects of the engagement. If you couple AS10 with this release that we're discussing now, is the effect that it's easier to bring some sort of an action against the engagement partner if there is an audit failure? It's kind of how does the landscape change for the engagement partner from what it was before today?
I think the answer is that it doesn't change, that the release doesn't purport to change anything that would make it easier to sanction an engagement partner for failing to carry out supervision responsibilities. An engagement partner's violation of the requirements in an auditing standard, whether it's 311 or its intended successor AS10, has always been sanctionable precisely because it's a violation of a standard. Section 105C6 provides a separate sort of additional procedural vehicle through which the board could sanction that person for that failure, but as I noted earlier in my comments, I think Section 105C6 is essentially redundant in that circumstance. So one of the principal points of the release is to highlight 105C6's application to failures of supervisory persons at other levels of the firm, but wouldn't, I think, change anything about that would make it easier to sanction engagement.
Okay, I mean, I guess I meant to ask the question from the perspective of whether it would make it easier to proceed against an engagement partner or expose them to additional liability from other sources. I mean, let me sort of ask the opposite question. I mean, in your comments, you spoke about the affirmative defense that's in the statute. Does the interpretive release make it harder to bring action against an engagement partner because there is a defined affirmative defense for a failure to supervise violation?
I would say no to that, too. I think a complete answer to that probably includes both a technical point and a practical point. The technical point is that the Act describes the affirmative defense only in reference to actions that the board would bring under 105C6. Nothing in the Act suggests that the affirmative defense discusses the affirmative defense in reference to actions brought for violations of other standards. So technically, there's no potential narrowing of the scope of AS10 liability or AU311 liability because of the affirmative defense. Now, having said that, as a practical matter, it's hard to imagine a circumstance in which the board would impose sanctions for violating AS10 if the facts are such that they would suffice to establish the 105C6 affirmative defense, because it would necessarily mean that the engagement partner had reasonably discharged supervisory duties under the firm's procedures and that the firm's procedures comply with relevant board rules and standards and would reasonably be expected to prevent and detect violations.
Okay, well, we do have a standard, AS10, that talks largely about the engagement partner's responsibility. I'm going to just ask you, I guess in broad terms, in general terms, if the answer is different with respect to some other kinds of people that one would think of as being in the hierarchy of supervision at a firm. And a lot of firms have professional practice directors. They have internal inspection programs with a director or head of internal inspections. There's typically a head of the audit practice itself, and then, of course, the firm has a CEO. How would the potential failure to supervise liability of these kinds of people be affected by the release?
I think an important part of the release is to describe that the scope of 105C6 potentially does reach those people, including the most senior personnel of even the very large firms, and that the way 105C6 is laid out, any of those people could be a supervisory person for Section 105C6 purposes. It would be sort of case-by-case, fact-specific inquiry about the nature of their responsibility, ability, or authority in relation to the conduct of the associated person who committed the particular violation.
Okay, well, let me touch on the scope of the board's ability to sanction people for failure to supervise. I think you mentioned this in your comments. Section 105 says that to sanction a firm or its supervisory personnel for failure to supervise, the firm must have failed to reasonably supervise an associated person, and the associated person must have violated the law. Sort of oddly, in my view, it doesn't say that the supervisor that's going to be sanctioned must himself have failed to supervise the guilty person. And what does that mean? Does that mean that all the supervisory people throughout a firm are responsible whenever there's some sort of a firm supervisory breakdown, even if they didn't themselves have any contact with the problem?
You're right that the Act is sort of oddly open-ended on that point. The release addresses that by describing the board's view that sanctions against individuals for a failure to supervise would only be appropriate against a person who, in relation to the underlying violation, had failed to exercise their supervisory responsibility reasonably with respect to that person who committed the violation. I think necessarily the question of whether the connection between unreasonable supervisory conduct and an underlying violation is sufficient to support sanctions for a failure to supervise is a question that would have to be addressed on a case-by-case basis in light of the specific facts. But the short answer to your question is that at least the release that we're recommending would describe the board's view that no, it's not as open-ended a liability to issue.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that has to be the answer, regardless of what someone might take away from text of the statute, just on an abstract reading. Let me ask you about something else that's a bit of an odd. The affirmative defense that you described is by its terms only available to supervisory persons of the firm. There's a footnote in the release that says, as a practical matter, however, the board would not expect to impose Section 105(c)(6)(a) sanctions against a firm if the board were persuaded that the affirmative defense conditions were met. Can you explain what that means? I mean, since the firm can only act through associated persons, does it mean that the firm isn't liable if no associated person or no supervisory person is liable, or is it getting at something else? Why is that there?
No, it doesn't quite mean that. There's a distinction that's maybe not obvious. I mean, the footnote is just acknowledging that even though the affirmative defense is not described in the statute as available to the firm, the reality is that in any situation where the elements of the affirmative defense would exist, the board wouldn't expect to impose sanctions against the firm, and that would submit that that's not surprising when you consider that the elements of the defense are that all of the relevant supervisory persons at the firm appropriately discharge their duties under the firm system, and that the firm system complies with applicable rules and standards of the board and would reasonably be expected to prevent and detect the violations. So in that circumstance, it's difficult to see how the firm could be said to have failed reasonably to supervise. But another part of your question, I mean, the footnote does not mean that the firm can't be liable unless an individual is liable. There could be circumstances, for example, where the firm's system does not comply with applicable rules and standards and would not reasonably be expected to prevent and detect violations. In those cases, perhaps specifically because of the gaps in the firm system, the relevant supervisory responsibility might not be able to sufficiently tie that to any individual. That would be the fault of the firm in devising a system. So situations like that could warrant failure to supervise liability against the firm, even though no such liability were imposed on an individual.
Okay, let me ask you about a different element of the scope of the ability to sanction people for failure to supervise. What's the standard of care? Is this a strict liability requirement? Is there negligent failure to supervise? Does scienter have to be shown?
With plainly not strict liability, I mean, that's evident from the act providing the affirmative defense. I think in the release described the board's view, as I mentioned before, that in addition to the connection between the supervisory responsibility and the underlying violation, the board would need to find that the supervisory responsibility was carried out unreasonably, which doesn't necessarily follow just from the fact of the violation. So it's not strict liability in that sense. The earlier question about negligence, the board sanctioning authority generally permits the board to impose sanctions for negligent failures. And the release describes the same understanding with respect to Section 105C6. It also notes that the Exchange Act provisions on broker-dealer liability and failure reasonably to supervise have been treated by the Commission as not requiring intentional or reckless conduct to impose sanctions.
I don't have the statute in front of me, and I hate to ask a question I don't know the answer to, but doesn't 105C6 include a scienter requirement?
No, it does not.
It does not.
Well, maybe that leads to another question that might be on a lot of people's minds. The interpretability of the release, it talks essentially about our enforcement ability to bring these failure to supervise. It's really a release about us and how we interpret this provision. Do you see ramifications here for private civil liability or supervisor?
Well, certainly the release doesn't change anything that would relate to private civil liability one way or another. And the concept of legal consequences for a failure to act reasonably is not unusual. I don't think the release is suggesting that Section 105C6 expects anything of individuals beyond acting reasonably and carrying out supervisory responsibilities that the firm gives them. It's probably relevant on this point that Section 105C6 doesn't actually make it unlawful to fail to supervise reasonably. It doesn't appear to create legal duties. It just authorizes the board to sanction people for certain failures to act reasonably. Whether such a failure would be a basis for private liability is a question that I wouldn't expect to be affected by Section 105C6.
Just to expand a little bit on what Michael said, I think it's important to note that under Sarbanes-Oxley, Section 105C6 is a disciplinary procedure available to the board. There's certainly no explicit private right of action under that provision, and to my knowledge, no one has suggested there is an implied private right of action there. It's theoretically possible, but I haven't heard that suggestion.
Sometimes I like to answer my own questions, and you gave sort of the answer I was thinking of giving. I mean, I guess the short answer is ultimately whether a particular statutory provision creates an implied private right of action is one for the courts, and the Court v. Ash, and that long line of cases coming from them. But because of the way this provision is worded as a sanctioning authority for us, not as a violation, I wouldn't think that it has any section in itself creating private liability.
Yeah, I agree with that, Tim.
And just, I mean, last but not least, and Bella, you spoke about sort of the two approaches that we're seeking comment on, the more general description of supervisory responsibilities and the more specific one. Can you do that again? Can you give a little bit more concrete example of what the difference between the two approaches would be? I think it's kind of hard to grasp.
I think the main difference between the two approaches is the level of detail and specificity that would be included in the potential rule. So taking an example, the board's quality control standards, QC20, and then in more detail, QC40, address the need for a firm to have policies and procedures relating to personnel management, which encompasses the hiring of personnel, assignment of personnel to engagement, professional development, and advancement activities. And applying the general approach to the rulemaking, a potential rule would build upon the existing requirement by stating that at a high level, the firm would need to assign appropriate individuals to design and maintain the policies and procedures relating to personnel management and document those specific assignments. In a more detailed approach, the potential rule would identify and define the areas of supervisory responsibility. So, for example, specific areas of responsibilities relating to personnel management could include the hiring of personnel with technical, with appropriate technical competence, the assigning personnel with appropriate technical competence to an audit engagement, overseeing the professional technical development of an individual employed by the firm, and the advancement activity of professional employees. So in summary, the main difference between the two approaches is that the detailed approach would just outline with more specificity the supervisory responsibilities the firms would need to assign.
If I could add to that, I just think that we would look to our existing quality control standards and indicate what are the areas of supervisory responsibility spelled out there, and then require that there be specific delegations of authority with respect to all of those areas of supervisory responsibility, and that those are clearly laid out in the firm's policy. A more general approach allows the firm to approach it the way they see it. So we're looking for comment as to which of those is the better approach, and we're hoping that it's better than other comments.
Okay. Thank you, Ryan. I certainly will be interested to see what comments we have. Let me ask the other board members if they have any other comments or any questions they'd like to ask about the failure to supervise release. If not, if there's no further discussion, then I'll call the question on this item. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? There are none. So motion carries unanimously. That completes our agenda for this meeting. There is one other matter that I'd like to take the occasion to raise and make some comments about, and that is the non-public nature of our enforcement proceedings. The discussion of failure to supervise presents the opportunity to discuss another aspect of the board's enforcement program. Under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the board's enforcement proceedings are non-public, unless the board finds there's good cause for proceeding to be public and the parties consent to public proceedings. The auditors and audit firms that we charge with violating PCOB standards or with other serious violations have little incentive to consent to opening the case against them to public view. On the contrary, the fact that absent consent, our enforcement proceedings are required to be secret, creates a considerable incentive to litigate. Litigation postpones, often for several years, the day on which the public learns that the board has charged the firm or auditor. I believe that the time has come for us to ask Congress to change the law and make our enforcement proceedings public, unless there's some good reason for a particular matter to be closed. Since so much of our enforcement work now occurs out of the public sight, it may be helpful to describe in general terms how the board's disciplinary process works. If, after a non-public investigation, the board votes to institute a disciplinary proceeding, the auditor or audit firm that has been charged has a choice between settling the case or litigating with the board's enforcement staff. If the choice is litigation, the matter is assigned to the board's hearing officer. After pretrial proceedings, there's a hearing at which the staff must prove its case and the respondent may present its defense. Evidence is introduced and witnesses testify. Once the hearing officer issues his decision, either party, the auditor or the enforcement staff, may appeal to the board. As in any appeal,
Parties file briefs and may request oral argument. If the board's decision is unfavorable to the auditor or the firm, they may appeal again, this time to the SEC. In that event, the board continues to be prohibited from reporting its decision to the public unless and until the commission allows the board-imposed sanction to take effect. From the initiation of the disciplinary proceeding to at least the SEC decision to let the sanctions commence, the entire proceeding takes place behind closed doors. This is in sharp contrast to an SEC administrative proceeding against an auditor. If the SEC were to bring the same case, alleging the same violations, against the same auditor, the SEC's charges would be disclosed at the time the commission instituted its proceeding. Any administrative trial would be open to the public. If there were an appeal to the commission and an oral argument, the public could attend. The ability or the inability of the commission staff to prove its charges would be a matter of public record. In the case of the PCOB proceeding, no other auditor, no investor, no audit committee, no member of the press or media is entitled to know what the board considers to merit discipline, whom we've charged, what issues are being litigated, and whether the board staff has won or lost. The public is in the dark about how the board uses its enforcement authority until there is a settlement or an SEC decision on the board's sanctions. For many years, the SEC faced a similar problem. Old SEC Rule 2E contained a presumption in favor of private disciplinary proceedings involving accountants, auditors, and lawyers. Because the proceedings against accountants and auditors were private, there were incentives for delay and protracted litigation. It was not unusual for cases against the major accounting firms to take many years to work their way through the non-public process. When I was general counsel of the SEC in the late 1980s, the commission changed the presumption in the rule from private to public disciplinary proceedings. Unfortunately, we find ourselves with the same problem that the commission confronted, but lack the option of solving it by amending the board's rules. Public proceedings would require a change in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. I believe the board should ask Congress to make that change so that the public will have the same access to our enforcement proceedings as to those of the SEC. Of course, as in the case of the SEC, board investigations to remain private and confidential, and the process of asking a firm or individual for a statement of position, which is similar to the SEC Wells process, should stay private. However, if the board votes to initiate formal disciplinary action, the administrative proceeding in which the validity of those charges is decided should normally be public. Changing this kind of legislation will not happen overnight. And of course, we will need to consult with the SEC and seek its support. I believe, however, that the time has arrived to begin that process. Our enforcement director, Claudius Modesti, is in the audience here. Claudius, let me ask if you have any comments about this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Division of Enforcement would very much welcome a change to the Act's requirement for non-public disciplinary proceedings. Over the last few years, we've commenced litigation involving a broad range of audits, and the enforcement program also has a significant inventory of ongoing investigations. I'm immensely proud of the division's accomplishments. Non-public disciplinary proceedings, however, are a major stumbling block for the board's enforcement program to most effectively protect investors and improve audit quality. As parties litigating with the board take full advantage of this non-public feature of the Act, investors, the audit profession, and others are prevented from knowing what auditor wrongdoing has allegedly occurred. Also, in the division's view, in certain of these proceedings, the defenses raised by the parties do not have substantial merit. These proceedings are initiated after well-developed fact-gathering investigations in which the parties are entitled to many procedural safeguards, such as right to counsel. Furthermore, before the board decides whether to bring a disciplinary case, My division generally provides those who may be charged with substantial notice of the potential charges against them and an opportunity to make a written submission explaining any disagreements or concerns they may have with the potential charges. First, those written submissions are diligently evaluated by the division before it decides whether to make any disciplinary recommendation to the board. Those written submissions are then provided to the board to consider, along with the division's recommendation, in deciding whether to bring a case. Thus, those who face charges have their concerns carefully considered before the board approves a litigated disciplinary proceeding. The requirement for non-public proceedings prevents litigated proceedings from coming to light until long after the information would be most relevant to investors, other auditors, and other interested parties. The need to prepare for and staff litigation also consumes substantial resources, which otherwise could be devoted to other important investigative work by the board's enforcement program. With less than 50 enforcement staff, about half of which are attorneys, it only takes a modest cluster of litigated proceedings to soak up a substantial amount of our attorney's time and effort. At the end of the day, because the Act's non-public proceedings shroud the results of a vast portion of the board's investigative work, the board's enforcement program is prevented from fully satisfying its investor protection objectives. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your leadership on this important issue. The Division of Enforcement stands ready to assist in any way as the board brings focus to this substantial impediment to the board's efforts to protect investors.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vedeschi. Let me ask if any of the other board members want to comment on this. Mr. Gradison, why don't we start with you?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This requirement in Sarbanes-Oxley for non-public enforcement procedures, in my opinion, is the most glaring anti-investor provision in the entire Act. And I think it's significant that only yesterday, the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee announced that on September 23rd, his committee is going to hold a hearing to explore whether a Freedom of Information Act exemption granted to the SEC in the new financial regulatory reform bill should be narrowed in scope. Now, there's a connection between these two. Both of them have to do with very important and useful information being denied to investors, and both of them can only be corrected through legislation. Normally, I'd be a little discouraged about the idea of trying to move a provision like our own because of the fact that major financial reform legislation just passed, and you know that doesn't happen every day. There's always a vehicle for change. But one thing I've learned over the years is that even with the best of intentions and drafting skill about the best prediction you can make when a major reform bill passes, that there'll be a technical correction still, probably within a year. And in this instance, it might even be quicker if the item that I mentioned, which was called to public attention just yesterday by Chairman Frank and also by the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Leahy of Vermont, if that starts to move. So I very enthusiastically support your calling attention to this. I think the timing is excellent, and I hope we can obtain the support from the SEC so that we can really even call this to the, if possible, call this to the attention of the Financial Services Committee as it prepares for the September 23rd hearing on what I consider to be a not unrelated subject. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. Gravison. Other comments? Okay. Mr. Niemeyer.
I also welcome the idea of the PCAOB proposing a legislative change to make litigated enforcement proceedings public, as the SEC does. As the chief accountant of the SEC's Division of Enforcement, I saw firsthand how important transparent proceedings are to the public's trust. And after 8 years of experience at the PCAOB, I am confident that rigorous independent auditor oversight, as envisioned in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, was critical to turning the profession off its destructive course leading up to Enron and WorldCom. But for independent oversight to garner the public trust, it needs to be more transparent. The current system establishes significant unintended incentives for gamesmanship by respondents to drag out litigation merely to make the ultimate conclusion so old that it's meaningless to investor protection when it finally comes out. Moreover, it deprives gatekeepers of important information to accomplish their responsibilities while proceedings are pending. Indeed, audit committees, analysts, and other gatekeepers have extensive experience in determining how much, if any, weight to put on the existence of a pending matter, as well as the arguments of the prosecution and the defense. I don't see any countervailing harm from transparency that would uniquely pertain to the PCOB disciplinary proceedings, but not to SEC or court proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Niemeyer. Mr. Harris?
I agree with you, Mr. Chairman, and Bill Gratis and Charlie Niemeyer, and believe that our disciplinary proceedings should be brought into line with those of other agencies, such as the SEC, the CFTC, the Department of Labor, and FDIC, and others. As you mentioned, SEC disciplinary hearings involving professionals were private until 1988, when the Commission amended its rules to make the hearings presumptively public. It is my understanding that the reasons cited by the Commission for the change included public proceedings are more favored in the law than closed-door proceedings. The public and other auditors have a legitimate interest in learning on a timely basis the facts and circumstances that have led to the institution of proceedings. The public and audit professionals are interested in timely disclosure of the standards used to commence disciplinary proceedings. Private proceedings create incentives for delay. At the SEC, virtually all other administrative proceedings brought by the SEC, including those against broker-dealers, investment advisors, and public companies, and all SEC injunctive actions are public. I believe that a number of the reasons cited by the Commission for their change in 1988 are equally applicable today to the PCOB. And as I said at the outset, I believe our disciplinary proceedings should be brought into line with standard practices of the regulatory body.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harris. I guess at this point I would just like to ask the General Counsel's Office if they could prepare a legislative proposal for the Board's consideration that would implement the idea of making the Board's proceedings, at least presumptively, public. I didn't contemplate a vote on anything here this morning since we don't have that proposal in front of us, but Gordon, if your office could do that.
We will do that, absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much. If there's no other business, that concludes our agenda today, and the meeting is now adjourned.